Hello and welcome to the Crack Movie Club, the show where we try to make you an expert on your favorite films. I'm Tom Ryman.
And I'm Alex Schmidt.
And we're the self-appointed crack movie experts. We're here to point out some things you may or may not have known about your favorite classics and drop observations that might ruin the movie for you, or maybe not, if you can be an adult about it. It's up to you, really. For the next 45 to 60 minutes, we'll be dissecting the following film, John Carpenter's Halloween from 1978. Along with us today is our guest, Jason Pargin, who is the executive editor at Cracked, and he's written some books or something.
Hello, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, and thanks for having me on, too. This is very exciting.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Obviously, Abe is still out, so Alex is filling in as my guest host, which is really just another guest.
Yeah.
So I have two guests.
But I'm the most spooktacular one yet.
Indeed, yeah.
Man. I like to think of us as all three being hosts.
That's true, yeah. That would have been appropriate for The Thing. See, because The Thing is a... Anyway.
Oh.
But Jason obviously writes for the site as David Wong, and he's written several horror novels. Obviously, the John Dies at the End series, which is one of the reasons why we wanted to have him on today, because we're talking about Halloween, which is one of the bigger, more influential horror movies.
Yeah, most recently, What the Hell Did I Just Read? His new novel.
Yes, yeah, that's right.
I try to title all of the books in such a way so that when someone is promoting them, it's not clear what part of the sentence was the book title. What the Hell Did I Just Read is the title of the book.
You should write a book called And We're Back with our guest David Wong.
Yeah.
Right.
Also, obviously, the movie takes place in Illinois. In a fictional town, Haddonfield, Illinois, and we also figured that was a nice connection because both Jason and Alex are from Illinois.
Yeah, I saw it's in a fictional town of Haddonfield in the real county of Livingston County, which is like three over from DuPage County, where I'm from, which is the Chicago suburbs. It's not particularly rural or anything, but yeah, I was like, oh, my roots. Here we go. Great,
but not really.
Yeah, but with a killer in them. And it's also clearly L.A. the whole
right,
time.
Right, it's a single street in Los Angeles. Before we begin, what we like to do, Jason, first of all, when was the first time you saw the movie?
Oh, gosh, I was a small child. I started seeing stuff like this when, oh, Lord, I was 8 or 9 years old, I think.
Oh, man,
that's awesome.
Did you?
Because the movie would have been in theaters when I was 3. I was born in 1975, so I'm sure as soon as it hit cable or whatever we had, that's when I would have seen it, because my brother was a little bit older. But yeah, no one stopped me from watching that stuff or reading it.
That's an interesting point, because this is a movie that is infamously very different in its broadcast television form, which we'll probably talk about later on in the podcast.
Yeah.
Well, Jason, if you will, would you favor us with a brief synopsis of the film?
Sure. It's a timeless tale that's been told many times.
Yes.
Basically, a violent patient named Michael Myers escapes from a mental hospital where he's been almost his whole life. His personal psychiatrist named Dr. Loomis thinks he knows where Michael is headed. Then, rather than organize a manhunt with like federal and state agencies, he instead buys a revolver and drives to the patient's hometown with the plan to hide in the bushes and ambush Michael and shoot him dead on sight. This plan is not a success, and indirectly, as a result, several teenagers are brutally murdered.
He does just spend the evening standing in the bushes.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite ways this movie is low budget. It's just such a non-hiding spot.
Yeah.
But it was just clearly, well, we can't shoot any more locations, so he's just going to stand behind the smallest bush in town.
Yeah.
And watch for the killer.
He's going to wait for him here.
For like the middle 45 minutes of the movie,
yeah.
It felt like he's standing there in that same bush. Like, they keep cutting back to him. It's like, man, he's still...
still hasn't moved.
He's still there, isn't he?
That's a pretty good synopsis.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty accurate. On this show, we like to compare your plot description to a few of our own rudimentary summaries, so feel free to join us in a segment we like to call Terrible Loglines. Two teenage couples 15 years apart turn off all the lights in the house to have sex for exactly 1 minute.
It's so fast. Blofeld saves America.
He does.
A small child puts on a clown costume once and immediately loses his soul.
Yeah, we don't know. Maybe he was just going upstairs to just... show that knife to his sister, but as soon as he puts on that clown mask, it's all over. A state-certified psychiatrist spends 15 years plotting the murder of a catatonic six-year-old.
An up-and-coming local slasher develops a sudden case of the yips.
Experts discover a small town in Illinois in which Jamie Lee Curtis is considered the ugly girl.
She's the frumpy one. A middle-class couple keeps a jack-lantern on their bedside table for no conceivable reason.
Gun doesn't kill people.
An after-school special produced by the U.S. Department of Make Sure the Killer is Dead.
There's like three different points where she's like, oh, well, that's done with, and throws the knife away, and he picks the same knife back up to continue trying to murder her.
Doesn't even really throw it away, just leaves it by the body.
Just kind of leaves it.
Amazing.
Well, somebody might want this. All right, I got one more. A man with a PhD spends an entire night standing in a driveway and fails to notice a car parked 10 feet away.
My final one, a psychiatrist catches up with one of his old patients.
I love that there's no words exchanged between them. Like, I don't even, does he even say his name?
He is not very diagnostic in his approach to chasing yeah. down Michael Myers.
Like, he doesn't even say Michael to get his attention or anything. He just shoots him.
Yeah.
Of course, he's in the process of strangling Jamie Lee Curtis to death, but.
Well, I love that bad log line because it makes me imagine, like, good Michael Hunting. You know, like, a lot of just holding him and telling him it's okay. And
it's not your fault.
Yeah.
We will talk later about how Dr. Loomis may not be that great of a psychiatrist. In the final analysis, usually if you've taken your child to see somebody and like years later, he's like, you know, I look into his eyes and there's no soul there.
It's pure blackness.
This pure blackness. It's the heart of evil. It's like, is there another doctor? Maybe work for them.
Somebody else.
Like maybe you've burned out on this profession and maybe you.
Right.
You should think about going ahead and taking retirement because this is not the only catatonic patient he's ever worked with. It's like, yeah, the boy didn't speak a word for 15 years. Like, yeah, you've got a lot of patients like that. They have something wrong with them and they can't speak. That's actually fairly common. That's why I knew he had to die.
I wonder how many of his patients, like, they don't speak, and he's like, it's the evil. It's pure evil. Like, that's his diagnosis for, like, 70% of his patients. Oh, that one's pure evil.
And then the patient's like, oh, I'm sorry, were you talking to me? I thought you were talking to somebody else. Pure evil.
I tried talking to him and just could nothing, no matter what I said, he, you know, I just couldn't get through. It's like, well, doctor, he's severely autistic. Like, he's non-communicative. That's in his file.
It's a broad piece of commentary on the state of mental health care in this country. All right, now that you know the plot, let's dive into the making of the movie from pre-production to post-production in a segment we call Expensive Pretending.
Yeah. How the movies get made.
Yeah, how the movies get made. God, we all have a bunch of notes here.
I'm excited just because I've been hearing the whole Carpenter month, and this is the third Carpenter feature film after Dark Star and Assault on Precinct 13. So mm-hmm. I feel like this movie also set the groundwork for all the other movies you guys have been talking about.
Yeah, definitely. It was definitely his first big success.
Yeah.
Like, this movie blew up.
Well, that's what I wanted to bring up is the context of this movie, because this is one where I feel like if the kids today watch it, it just has to seem like the most boring, toned down. Because so many things in this became standard. Like, it kind of wrote the language for slasher movies for the next couple of decades. Like, the 80s were built on this model of, you know, the killer is a huge guy in a mask. He's invincible. It's the suburbs or a small town. The parents aren't present. It's the targets are teenagers. Often they seem to be getting punished for having sex. There's all these things that we now take for granted to the point that, like, I can't watch the movie Psycho and be frightened by the shower scene. I've seen it parodied 5 million times. Like, it has no impact on me. When at the time Psycho came out, people were like having heart attacks in the theater.
Yeah.
It's so difficult to explain to people. Like, gosh, you got to understand, in 1978, like, you had the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. That was a few years prior. And, of course, you had Psycho. But the slasher movie as, like, a template, like, where, oh, it's a slasher movie. Like, this kind of invented a genre. It wasn't the first.
Yeah.
But the idea that you get one of these every single year for the next 30 years, that's what it gave us.
Yeah, I think we had Black Christmas, which was directed by A Christmas Story's Bob Clark, of all people, a little bit before that. And that was sort of, but it didn't, it's a slasher movie. It's a teen slasher movie, but it didn't have the impact of this. And I think I read somewhere that Carpenter actually called Bob Clark and was like, hey, do you mind if we do this? Because it's kind of like a space you sort of recreating. But yeah, it's interesting. Like we mentioned Psycho and Texas Chainsaw Massacre. They're both what you would call slasher movies, I guess, but they're both, all three of these films, Psycho, Texas Chainsaw, and Halloween, are constructed very, very differently.
Yeah.
Like the Jason mentioned the shower scene, which the shower scene seems somehow more modern than Halloween, because Halloween's all about the slow burn. Like they adjust with the Steadicam, I think had just become the Panaglide is what the official name of it is. But it's a Steadicam rig, so we get all these long tracking shots. And I guess Psycho is in the beginning too, but like Psycho scene, I've watched it recently, it seems surprisingly modern, particularly like with Anthony Perkins' performance and like the kineticism, I guess, of the shower scene, particularly when compared to Halloween, which is just such a, it's slow. It's a slow burn that's just like a slowly tightening a noose and like showing you these places that are normally safe and then showing Michael Myers in them, but he just keeps showing up in every single place. You don't know where he's, when he's finally going to attack. It's much more about like the, I'm just going to make you keep waiting. I'm going to keep telling you that, I'm going to give you all the information that this murderer is in all of these places. He can come from anywhere, but I'm not going to have him spring until like you're least expecting it.
You guys are both big horror fans and well-versed in the genre. And I have pretty much always been afraid of it. And so I watched this for the first time to prepare for this show. And I was not in the least bit scared the entire time. It was not scary to me. It was a little scary toward the end at one point. And otherwise, I was just like, oh, okay, I have seen all this in culture throughout just being a person. Like, well, yeah. It's been imitated and reused and repurposed because it basically invented a genre so much that now it's like, oh, okay, sure, the things. I get it. Yeah, right.
Yeah, definitely.
And let me give you an example of that. For you watching it, I'm sure even though you're not a fan of horror, you know these killers, the masked killers, you know they're invincible, right? Like, you know that shooting Jason Voorhees doesn't stop him. Shooting Freddy Krueger doesn't stop him.
Right, so you weren't surprised then, when Michael gets stabbed and he's still alive. Like,
yeah, I was just like, okay, so he gets up and we keep going. Yeah, right.
And that rule had not been established at this point in 1978. Like, that had happened in movies before, but the way it builds, because he's not a supernatural character, it's just, the whole point is he's mysterious. So you see her wound him in a minor way, and then she like stabs him in a much more serious way that probably should have incapacitated, you know, a normal person. And then at the end, when he gets shot and blown off the balcony and then gets shot six times and then falls, you know, 10 feet to the ground, I think a lot of people in the audiences at the time were like, oh, that's the end of the movie. It's this crazy killer. Because those first two wounds, it's like a very motivated, you know, very crazy person.
Well,
to
there's
overcome
like
that.
There's like an escalation to them too. Like you said, she kind of wounds him in a minor way, and then they like escalate in seriousness until he's finally shot and falls off the balcony. So audiences then must have been like, oh, thank God, finally you got him. Like, because nobody's getting up from that.
And then he's gone.
Yeah.
Yeah, he walks out there and it's just empty yard. And so that's a reveal. In this movie, that is a reveal that, oh, this guy was invincible all along. This guy was not human all along. But now it's completely lost because, like, well, of course he's not out there. They made 13 more of these movies. Like, duh. At the time, like, it's the context was totally lost.
So the way this movie got made, the producers were Mustafa Akkad and another gentleman whose name I've lost.
Yablans, was it?
Yes. Irwin Yablans. Okay, so it's two producers, a producer named Irwin Yablans and Mustafa Akkad, who was a producer financier. They approached John Carpenter to make a movie called The Babysitter Murders that they wanted to make after seeing Assault on Precinct 13. Yeah, that's a terrible title. But they approached him because they had this idea for a movie they wanted to make. They figured it would be profitable. Basically, Akkad, he didn't see the script when he approved it. Carpenter pitched him the film in like a sort of like a verbal beat-by-beat way, like describing how the movie was going to look and how it was going to be told, because that's so much what this movie is. Like, there's very little story. Yeah. So he described that to him and then also told him, oh, by the way, I don't want to take a salary and we can make this for $300,000. So they were like, yep, you can make it. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Greenlit.
Yeah, apparently he pitched that to them and they were just like, okay, we'll just go ahead and make the movie. Like, the process was complete from the studio end, so to speak. And then they also, Blanz suggested setting the movie on Halloween night. And so Carpenter and his partner, Deborah Hill, said, oh, okay, we'll call it Halloween and center it on that and have a much better title than
the
entire franchise.
Yeah.
Great.
Babysitter Killer.
That Babysitter Murders makes me think of those Babysitter's Club books.
Yeah, it's all
but
I can
just
think
with
of.
A like murder element.
Right. Yeah. It's like the Fear Street version of this. So yeah, Carpenter wrote the script with Deborah Hill, who was his producer-writing partner and was his girlfriend at the time. So they banged out the script. Carpenter handled all of Loomis's really overwrought, not really over, I think Donald Pleasance is a good enough actor that he delivers them well.
Yeah.
It's still pure exposition, everything he says, while Deborah Hill did the dialogue for the teenage girls.
Yeah, I think Loomis's whole job in the movie seems to be someone tells him everything's fine, and then he says it's not. Like, that's just every exchange.
He's
every
explaining
time.
To us what's happening.
Yeah, in an American accent that somehow has twinges of British villain. It's great.
Yeah, like, he's
it's
perfect.
Really good. Yeah.
He's amazing in this movie.
Just to be clear, to the people listening, I, at the very least, think this is a great film. Like, it's became a classic for a reason. We're making fun of it, but it's what they did is kind of an achievement beyond the fact that it cost $300,000 to make it and made $70 million. But the script is not good. And as a person who only writes for a living, I'm fascinated by this kind of thing because it's such a bare-bones story. Like, basically, they told him... They gave him the idea it's going to be the babysitter murders and this babysitter's getting murdered. So somewhere, how long did they say they spent on the script? It was only a couple of weeks, right?
I think I read 10 days.
Yeah, it was real
and
fast.
And that's normal. Yeah, and again, for people at home, a script, that's like 120 pages of text. Like, and most of that time is not spent writing. Most of that time should be spent thinking about the structure of the story, things you want to happen. You really shouldn't be able to pound out a good 120-page story in a week and a half. Not if you've done it right. It should take a little bit. It's clear the script part is not the important part to him.
Yeah.
The music is extremely important. How it's shot is extremely important. So you have an example here of a script that is really sloppy. Like, for instance... If you were to do a second draft of the script, which I'm confident what we saw was in fact the first draft of Halloween.
I'm sure I think they had 4 total weeks of production. Like, it was something like 4 total weeks of 20 odd days and then like maybe 2 or 3 weeks of pre-production, so it was just barely over a month total for it to work. So they probably just didn't have time to write a second draft.
So if you were to go back and try to do a second draft of this script, the first thing you would find out is that Dr. Loomis probably does not need to be in it. Because if you're writing it and you've got the victims, the teenage victims, and you decide, well, we need like an authority figure with a gun to be the guy who's hunting Michael, the sheriff character who is in the movie, it's the one of her friends, is that Annie's father is the sheriff?
Yeah.
You could have him do that because then you can have it as like the mystery. It could be sort of like the way No Country for Old Men is set up, where you've got this figure that comes sweeping into town and you're kind of following this small town suburban sheriff trying to put together what in the world's going on. So then if you want the overwrought speeches that Dr. Loomis makes that John Carpenter seemed to think were really important to the story, you can have at some point that sheriff like contacts Dr. Loomis and he gets the ominous speech over the phone, like, you know, he has no soul or whatever.
Yeah, that could.
And then that foreshadows.
It could have been accomplished in a single speech. We get it like 4 times, I think, in the film.
Right, including in the opening. So anyway, but instead we get this thing where the most expensive and most famous actor, Donald Pleasance, got the role of Dr. Loomis, but he's actually unnecessary. So you get this thing where you see him go pick up Michael and then find out he's escaped. And then we kind of follow him as he trails Michael across the state back to the town where we already know he's going. So it's not like he's uncovering a mystery for us. We're just sort of watching him fart around on Michael's trail to solve a mystery that we, the audience, already know the answer to. And then he's forced to stand in a bush for 30 minutes or so of runtime.
Stand over a bush, really.
He happens...
And frighten some children that come
next
up
to a bush.
It's like, oh, I'm bored. I'll scare these children.
Yeah, until he finally, in the climax, realizes he's in the wrong location and notices the car that's been parked there the entire film.
Yeah.
And then goes and gets to have the hero moment shooting Michael, which is not earned at all. There's no character arc that is completed for him. That should, that kill should either go to Lori, or if you wanted to work the sheriff in, have it be him, like this challenge to this small town he's protecting and whatever, he has to rise to that occasion. But it's one of those things that it's like you've got a character who doesn't have enough to do. That's something you spot very quickly when you're revising a story.
Right.
But this wasn't the situation. Like, they wrote it and then they went right into production. Yeah. And that's just, and now that guy's been in many more movies after this, including the remake, and he still has nothing to do.
Yeah, that's, yeah, he spends Act Two doing nothing, just standing around.
That's all true, and it seems like it's because Donald Pleasance was such a big get for them. Like, it seems like he's given much more to do than he deserves because they were very excited to have him in the film.
Well, they only had him for 4 days. So they
Which
had
is amazing.
Yeah. I think if I were to make the argument...
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. They had to get all his stuff real fast. Yeah.
Yeah, and they only had the Bush for 2 days. So.
Yeah. The Bush was... Yeah, the Bush really tried to big league them. I could say in defense of that is, I guess having Loomis be our in saved them some time in other ends, because he's our in the beginning when they to see Michael's escape, and then he's our in to follow him to Haddonfield. Like, you know, oh, I know where he's going.
Yeah.
So it cuts out some stuff where we'd have, if it was the sheriff instead, he'd have to like be made aware of the escape, be made aware of who Michael is, and then have reason to call Dr. Loomis. So it's probably something that could have been ironed out in a second draft, but I understand why the character exists. It's just clearly by Act Two, he's like, well, there's nothing for this character to do. But yeah, Donald Pleasance was the big get for this movie.
Because he has a massive title card right at the top. Like, sure watching does. This, especially going into it, I was like, okay, it's the first, like, Jamie Lee Curtis big movie and other people are in it. And then when the credits start rolling, the name Donald Pleasance in, and then, like, smaller after that, Halloween. It's amazing. And I'm like, oh, the guy who was Blofeld and You Only Live Twice is the hook of the entire movie? Okay, interesting.
Kids might recognize him from the current season of Mystery Science Theater 3000 in Puma Man.
Oh, I want to watch that now.
Yeah.
And apparently they offered that role to Peter Cushing and to Christopher Lee, who both turned it down. But that was going to be their in for, we'll get one famous English actor and that'll legitimize this whole enterprise. And they got Donald Pleasance. Good for them.
Carpenter was afraid, very intimidated by Pleasance because of his stature. And they had a lunch meeting when he was agreeing to the film. He just straight up told John Carpenter, I don't understand this movie. I don't understand my character. So he at least understood Jason's point. But he was like, but I'm going to do this movie because I have a daughter who is in a rock band in England, and she really liked the music you made for Assault on Precinct 13.
Not even the movie, the music. The soundtrack. Amazing.
Which, if you know anything about John Carpenter, you kind of realize that the movies are really just a vehicle for his music.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because otherwise he couldn't get people to listen to it. But I think if he could do away with the movie part and just play people this soundtrack, you probably would have preferred that. Because I'm telling you, it is the star of the show.
Oh, yeah,
and
the
I'm
music's...
not being sarcastic here. The score, if you try watching this, if you had somebody, and somebody on YouTube has probably done this, trying to mix this with the score of some generic movie, it would come off like the lamest bit of straight to VHS garbage.
Yeah.
But the score makes it.
In point of fact, it was originally screened, when they originally screened it for someone, for one of the executives, it didn't have the music in yet. And so it went very poorly. They're like, it's not scary. And so he's like, all right, here. And he put the music in. And the person was like, oh, this works. Like, this is, you know, completely changed. Oh, this is a great film. It's terrifying, you know. And it's all because the only thing he changed was adding the music to it.
Well, and he also told an interviewer that he had already written that theme years before because, quote, it was just something I tinkered out on the piano. I played 5/4 time on an octave on a piano. That's all it was. I hadn't necessarily applied it to Halloween. It was just sitting there, and I thought, oh, I'll use this. That works okay.
And it's, I think it's great. It's
an
odd time signature too. And I think that comes from, he has a musical background. Like, I think his dad's dad's some kind of a conservatory teacher or something.
Well, and this year, 2017, he's going on tour.
Oh, yeah. He's been on tour.
Just to play his soundtracks for people with a band of his son and his godson and the rhythm section from Tenacious D.
Yeah.
Which sounds like an amazing group.
The backing band from Tenacious D. It's not just his movie themes. He's playing like music he didn't end up using in any movies or anything. He's just playing his music.
Yeah, that's awesome.
It's awesome. One other casting point. This is Jamie Lee Curtis's first movie. Weirdly, she didn't start pursuing a performing career until she turned 18. Like, she didn't want to be a child star, I guess. They had offered, someone had called, her mother's Janet Leigh and her dad is Tony Curtis, so she comes from a performing family, and her mother had gotten a call about somebody wanting to audition her for The Exorcist. Jamie Lee never heard that call. Like, her mother was just like, nope, she won't be doing that. So this is her first movie, and on the commentary, it's pretty great. It's between him and Jamie Lee Curtis, and they're trying to remember who the other, like, it came down to Jamie Lee Curtis and this other actress, and they're trying to remember who she is, and the only recollection John Carpenter can pull up is that it was, quote, the girl from Jaws 2. That could be that could be one of, like, half a dozen people.
It's a female shark.
Right. It's the shark. Some notable people on the team I wanted to bring up. Dean Cundey is the director of photography. He did a couple other of the Carpenter films we talked about. Actually, all of them except for The Thing. And he, this was the first time he worked with John Carpenter.
Yeah.
And he's really good. I mean, the lighting in this movie is great, considering what they had to work with. It's all suburban interiors. Those are the real interiors, I think, of those homes.
And even some of the houses are, the Michael Myers house was a really abandoned house that they found.
Yes,
and then they used it in its abandoned form. And then in order to get the beginning of the movie when people live there, on one of the last days of production, they like finally painted it and dressed it.
Inside and painted it, hung curtains, put furniture in there.
Yeah.
It was the very last day of shooting. One way they saved money is that Cundey owned all of the equipment that they used to film the movie. So like the Steadicam, which was pretty much brand new, the cameras, all that stuff. Like, it was all his. So they didn't have to like pay extra to get that stuff.
Yeah.
It's like, it's such a great, like, low budget, like, spirit. Cause that's like making videos in high school where you just call the friend who has the video camera. Like,
yeah, it's very internet too. Like, that's how we've made basically anything I've made outside of a company is, oh, my friend has a thing. Let's do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and especially him having a Steadicam is pretty neat because it had come out in 1975 and the inventor of it had made a demo reel for a couple of directors. So Kubrick used it and John G. Avildsen used it in Rocky. And so it had been in a few movies, but he and Carpenter made a point of using it for the whole beginning of this movie, Halloween.
They use it for almost the entire film.
Yeah.
So many of the shots are the Steadicam shots, long takes, and it gives you this kind of like dreamy, kind of creepy quality to what's going on, which is both intentional and it's also an economic reason. The reason why I think we talked about this on the Escape from New York episode, but the reason why there's so many long takes in this movie is because it's just economically more practical.
Right, like just if you knock out more of the
stuff. If you can get everything in the one shot, then like it costs way less money. You don't have to, you know, cut and set everything back up. And
I find Escape from New York to be kind of a slow, tedious movie. Like, I'm not crazy about how it works there.
Mm-hmm.
Here, I think along with the music, it makes the film.
Yeah.
Because the way he shoots it, and I'm sure this was on purpose, even in the scenes where Michael's not in the vicinity, he'll shoot the girls from like a stalker's point of view.
Yeah, exactly.
Where like the teenage girls will be walking down the sidewalk, like chatting about school or homecoming or whatever. But this camera is across the street and it's tracking along with them like a creepy old man.
Yeah.
And their sound is kind of like far away. And that and the score, it makes it clear why, like if you watched it without the score, you would think, does he not know where to put the camera? But that and the score, it's so ominous. And it's so like it's uncomfortable because it's like, yeah, these people are being watched.
Yeah.
And it's these long.
Every sequence is it feels predatory.
Well, even because the very beginning of the movie, you spend the first, I don't know, 5 minutes being Michael Myers as a kid.
Yeah.
And then so much of the rest of the movie has parts where you're watching the characters from far away and over his shoulder. Like his shoulder is most of the frame. And
yeah.
It's like, so I'm him now. Cool. Great.
Yeah. Like weirdly, so much of this movie is from Michael's point of view.
Yeah.
And not just like literal POV shots, but like you're seeing like, because you'll see him in the shot, but it'll, like this is what he's doing. You know, like you're seeing it from his vantage now.
Yeah. And I don't think it's the point of the movie or what they're going for, but parts of that almost felt like the movie Funny Games kind of thing where it's like, oh, am I supposed to feel bad about how I enjoy movies?
Oh,
or
it's
something
like
I'm in the perspective. I don't think that's what they're going
making
for.
Making you culpable.
But it's so much of being the killer throughout the movie that it's a little bit distracting in a good way. It's like, oh, great.
I think it might deliberately be part of that discomfort. Yeah.
Yeah.
Michael Myers' mask is something I want to point out. It was created by Tommy Lee Wallace, who served multiple roles on the film. He was a production designer, location scout, co-editor, and art director. he bought a Captain Kirk mask, which is the mask you see in the film, and just modified it slightly. Like, he made the eye holes bigger, he painted it white, and they dyed the hair completely black. And it's John Carpenter had a pretty good quote that I'll just read. It's like, I can only imagine the result if they hadn't painted the mask white. Children would be checking their closet for William Shatner.
Just... Okay, but I'm trying to imagine, has anyone got a picture of what that mask, when it was sold, what it looked like before it was painted? Because I'm having trouble figuring out how that mask could make you look like William Shatner.
Yeah. it seems like a very Point Break robber mask.
Oh, yeah,
like,
yeah.
It's too big and kind of garish.
It's not like a Freddy Krueger mask where it's got like a distinct, you know, it's just a mask of a white guy with brown hair. I can't figure out, like, what would you ever in a million years look at somebody's like, oh, you're William Shatner? Because it's not, again, a Captain Kirk costume is different. That's a Starfleet uniform. You don't need the mask for that.
Yeah.
So the fact that they were selling a William Shatner, the actor mask.
Well, it's a Captain Kirk mask, but yeah, like...
It's a Halloween costume for being afraid of that thing on the wing of the plane in the Twilight Zone.
There's so of the wing.
TJ Hooker.
I think Tommy Lee Wallace was, Jason made a mention of something in the notes that I thought was hilarious. Tommy Lee Wallace was responsible for collecting up prop leaves and painting them, which they scattered in the scenes.
This is one of the things that will ruin the movie for you, but we have to point this out because it was shot. It's supposed to be in Illinois on Halloween. Which in Illinois Halloween, there's no leaves on the trees. You've got, you know, several inches of dead leaves on the ground. Well,
right.
This is shot in L.A.
in the spring.
In the spring. Yeah. And everything's bright green in the background. So to compensate, they had like one bucket of fake fall leaves that someone with their hand kind of dribbled in front of the camera every now and then.
They threw it in front of a fan each time. And that's why you only see, like, in scenes where, like, Laurie's carrying the pumpkin to the curb and she's watching the six trick-or-treaters that exist in this town. That's why the leaves are only in the foreground. There's, like, none in the background. There's none across. It's because they only had, like, a little bit of fake leaves to use.
And I like the detail that most of the actors are wearing their own clothes.
Oh, yeah.
Well, when they shot the show Seinfeld, I guess Jerry Seinfeld and many members of the other cast asked, like, why can't we just wear what we wore to the set? And apparently that's not a thing. And they didn't understand, like, yeah, but you're putting us in costume, but we're just dressed like friends of a comedian, which we are. So why can't we just wear what we're, like, why do we have to change clothes to shoot the show? They didn't understand. That's a very reasonable question, because it's not... Like, this takes place in the Knights of the Round Table era. It's not like they needed suits of armor. So it's like, well, yeah, just show up, just wear whatever you've got, you know?
Yeah, it was another budget thing. They just, you know, this is very, very small budget, even for the 70s. So the only person, I think the only person they did a real wardrobe buy for was Jamie Lee Curtis. And they went to JCPenney and they just bought a bunch of, they went to JCPenney in the mindset, okay, we're going to buy a bunch of clothes that'll make it look like Laurie's mother buys her clothes for her.
Yeah.
And so that's what they did. Everybody else is just, I think the other girls and pretty much everybody else in the film is apparently just wearing their own bullshit to the set that day.
And it's fine. It's authentic because, yeah, that is what those people would wear because it is what they wear.
Right. Yeah. In terms of unnecessary expenses to cut when you're working on a tight budget, that's definitely, you know, like you say, we're not playing knights, we're not in space, we're just teenagers in suburbia, we can just wear our own clothing.
And it was a slow building hit. Like, it wasn't something that started out right away as a smash thing. They put it in one theater in Kansas City, Missouri, and then it just sort of grew through word of mouth in the Midwest until it was everywhere in the country.
It blowing up owes itself to to a lot of things, but in particular, two specific, very important reviews, one by Tom Allen of The Village Voice and another by Roger Ebert. They both gave the film very positive reviews, and they both compared it to Psycho.
Yeah.
And that sort of, I guess, opened up the floodgates for the movie, and it just started to open everywhere. And then, you know, that's when it started pulling in all them sweet teenage murdering dollars.
And then Carpenter, since it wasn't a hit yet after it was out and he had made it, he just started doing other gigs. And he did two TV movies before he was then set up with, oh, you made the biggest hit horror movie ever made. We should start to have you do movies again.
Yeah.
And one of the TV movies was an Elvis TV movie that starred Kurt Russell. So then he was united with Kurt Russell for the first time.
Yeah.
So that worked out great. Yeah. And I think the other starred Adrienne Barbeau. So he met her there and then he kind of built his whole team.
Yeah. That's cool.
One thing I've never totally understood, because I'm a little too young to know, is, you know, this was before home video was common. Like, I'm sure that video cassette recorders existed in 1978, but in terms of there being a mass market for video cassettes, that you're talking 1984, 1985, around that era. Like, they were extremely expensive. The machines were prior to that.
Yeah.
So if you have a movie like this where they did not make this thinking it was going to set the world on fire, or, you know, this was not going to be, you know, Star Wars. So, like, what did they foresee for this? Like, what was the fate of those low budget kind of B movies? Were there just like dollar theaters and stuff where they played?
Dollar theaters, TV, I think was a big market.
Yeah, for TV. Yeah.
And that's a good lead into this next point, which we mentioned at the top of the podcast. Carpenter had to film additional scenes for this movie after, you know, production wrapped, after the movie was released in theaters, specifically for its television, for its broadcast version, because the film as it is back then was not long enough to fill a 2-hour time slot, which is crazy to sound right, because it's an hour and a half. Like, you'd have to probably cut something out of that to fit in it, but back then commercial breaks were less frequent and less long.
They were gentleman advertisers.
Yeah.
Like, no, we won't take that much of an audience's time, please.
So he had to actually go back and film a bunch of extra scenes, and they're mostly just inconsequential filler. Like, there's a scene of Loomis arguing with his superiors that Michael shouldn't be moved to a minimum security prison, and there's a scene where I forget her name, the one that's not Annie.
Linda?
Linda, yes. Is sort of walks over to Laurie's house and sort of pestering her about getting her to borrow, letting her borrow a blouse of hers for the dance the next day. They're really like nothing scenes except for one. And it's a scene where Loomis goes into the hospital the day after Michael escapes, and the nurses are showing him Michael's room, and it's all like torn up and broken and junk. And they're like, but what we really wanted to show you was this. And then they close the door and he scrawled the word sister on the back of his room door.
Spooky.
Which became this, like in subsequent sequels, they sort of retconned it so that Laurie turned out to be Michael's long lost sister. And that's like the beginning of that idea, which Carpenter is vocally not a fan of that idea. He's like, well, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. It really doesn't.
So it's like he invented a scene just for the purposes of making it a viable product to be sold to television stations that kind of ruins this movie.
In the overall history of the franchise, it seems like he wasn't that interested in even stretching out the Michael Myers story that much more.
Oh, no.
He refused to direct Halloween 2. And then when it was time to make a Halloween 3, he let the people making it do a story completely without Michael Myers or any of the story from the first two movies because they thought, oh, maybe we do like a horror anthology under the Halloween umbrella. He didn't seem to have any need to explore Michael Myers' life beyond he's a force of evil in one movie.
And that's interesting, is the Friday the 13th series was originally conceived the same way, is that each film each film would be called Friday the 13th. The only thing that would connect them was that they would take place on Friday the 13th, but they would be like a completely, so in reality, like Friday the 13th, the series, is much closer to the original vision of the films.
What a true ripoff of Halloween. Even down to that.
I think that that's having a franchise like that where you switch it out every time. I think that's always the dream, because you don't, in a normal franchise, what happens is the actors you bring back get more and more expensive, right? To the point where now Robert Downey Jr. is making like $86 million to appear in 5 scenes in Spider-Man Homecoming. Because as it goes, they demand more money. So an anthology series where people will come back for the brand, but you don't have recurring stars, you can just keep bringing in unknowns.
Yeah.
And you're making the money because the star is the franchise and not the actors. So it's like, well, we'll just switch it out every year with a new story.
Right.
Get some young and hungry writer, a young and hungry, you know, director to do it. Some, you know, pretty faced, some young unknown girl to be the new victim, and just do that. It just, it doesn't work, because the odds of you coming up with a plausible idea every time, but especially trying to shift gears in the third movie after you've done a part two.
Yeah, it's so
and
weird.
The audience are like waiting for Michael to show up, and he just never does.
They also tried to do it in Friday the 13th. They tried to do it in part five by bringing in a different person to be the killer. And it's the same thing with Halloween 3. People hated it. They were like, where's Jason? Like, why isn't he in this movie?
But the thing with the sister thing, that's something that I do feel like, because they actually corrected, I'm using air quotes, they corrected this for the 2007 Rob Zombie remake. Because I think if you had like a script doctor or something look at the first, at that Halloween script, they would say, well, what does Michael Myers want? Like, what's the villain trying to accomplish? And you have this vague thing where he's killing the babysitters because he killed his sister babysitter when he was a child or whatever. And I think I could easily see a screenwriter saying, no, he's got to have a connection, because initially, like, Loomis thinks he's going back to his old house, mm-hmm. because in his crazy brain he thinks he lives there.
Yeah.
And that's reasonable to assume, but that doesn't happen.
I gotta correct you, he does. The first, after he escapes, and then we see, the first time we see Laurie, she's walking down the street with Tommy, the little boy she's gonna eventually babysit, and her father, who's a realtor, asks her to drop the key off at the Myers house. And so she walks up to the door and drops the key off at the Myers house. And that's when Michael steps into view. We see him. So he was sitting in his house. Lord knows what he was doing. Like, I think he's already stolen his sister's headstone at this point. But that's when he sees Laurie as she comes up to the house and puts the key in. So he's like, boom. So now he's got somebody to follow. And that's when he starts following her. And he just follows her from there and sees her friends. And so it all kind of trickles out from there.
Well, but that, right. But I'm saying, like, in the when they did the remake, they restructured it more like a traditional movie where he is coming back home and he is squatting in that house. And then his first kills are because he's intruded upon in
right.
that house.
Yeah.
Like, he just comes back there to come back home due to whatever the demons in his brain. And then he kills because someone comes there while he's there. And so he sees like a picture of her and is like, oh, that's my sister, because I remember when I saw her as an infant.
Yeah.
And she's now, this is what she would look like 15 years
yeah,
later.
Yeah, he has photo aging and software in his head from Unsolved Mysteries.
And in that movie, they've got it some sort of thing where he like has some ritual where he needs her to kill him or something. Like, they try to tie it up in a neat bow. But I think it winds up making it scarier that there's not any internal logic to what he's doing.
Yeah.
And I think this is what every single, like the sequels and remakes, everyone else gets wrong, is that in horror, you can have the unknown be one of the elements of the horror. It's not a flaw. It's just that it can't be a thing where the people in the movie know and the audience doesn't. You have to have a point where the people in the movie are like, what does he want? And then other people are like, we don't know.
Yeah.
He's crazy. And to make it clear, like, I didn't miss a scene somewhere. Like, why is he doing this? Like, make it clear. They don't know. That's what's scary about it.
Yeah, I think the remake misses the entire point, which I guess we'll get into, because we got to kind of move forward.
We can just briefly get into it. We don't have to go over it at length. I think it's worth watching because it gives you a view of how bad of a movie the original could have been.
Right, yeah. It's because it ruins the whole point. Like, it overcomplicates it. And like you were just saying, the whole point of Michael Myers as a character is that he's not a character. Like, he's an right. abstract. Like, he's like, there is no reason for the things that he does.
Yeah, there's just evil in the world and he's evil.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the script, what do they call him?
The Shape.
They don't call him Michael Myers.
They call him the Shape.
The Shape.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it. That's very purposeful.
Yeah.
Because I was watching the credits carefully because I was like, oh, who was in the suit? And I was like, well, I don't know, but there's the Shape in the movie.
Yeah, a lot of people were in the suit. One of them is Nick Castle, who is just a friend of Carpenter, who went on to write a lot of movies. Hook, I think he wrote.
Yeah. And wasn't it Escape from New York he co-wrote or something?
I think so. He definitely was present for Escape from New York, and then he also directed Major Pain. So he's just some random guy, and like, all he's doing is, like, somebody asked Nick Castle, it's mostly him as the Shape. There's some other scenes, like when the little boy looks across the street and sees Michael just standing in front of the other house. I'm pretty sure that's Deborah Hill, and it's literally whoever was there who could put on the Myers, because again, that was kind of part of it.
It's like just a group,
it doesn't matter. Like, Michael's a mask, he's a shape, so it didn't matter who played it. And somebody once asked Nick Castle what his motivation was. Like, what was Michael's motivation? He's like, my motivation was a guy who was trying to walk to his mark correctly. Like, that's all he's doing is just, Carpenter's like, yeah, now walk there. Now kind of turn your head. All right. Like, that's just all he's doing.
Yeah, good job, Shape. Yeah.
He deliberately didn't want him to walk like a monster or do anything like a monster. He just walk normal.
That
just
is
be
really
normal.
Cool about it. Yeah.
But the remake, because of the way, like, the remake is suddenly fascinated by Michael Myers as a person.
Yeah.
It spends the first 36 minutes in his childhood, like where the original movie is just that opening scene of 4 minutes or however long it is.
Yeah.
It's 36 minutes. So he's clearly the protagonist now. And the explanation for why he became a murderous demon is he had the same childhood as most of my friends from back home. And Tom, I'm a bet that you know people who had the exact, it's like, oh my gosh, his dad was on disability and out of work and his mom was a stripper.
Yeah.
And oh my gosh, they yell at each other all the time. And all I can think about is, man, I bet that mom made good money though, stripping. Like,
or you're like, oh yeah, that was more... Ricky's parents, you know? Like...
Yeah, between his disability check and her all cash she's taking home, probably doing that under the table by having to pay taxes, like, that's not bad. And that house is not bad. Like,
that's a nice house.
You know, it's like, to people in LA, it's like, man, can you imagine, you know, what that does to a man's mind growing up with your dad is drunk all the time. They're yelling at each other and throwing stuff at each other. And, you know, it's you just couldn't help but snap and just want to destroy the world. It's like, no, that was like 80% of the people in my high school. That was
right. It would just be a society of masked people at that point. Like, it would just, everyone would become that.
I'm gonna move us forward into the next segment here. We're going to get into some kind of observations, some kind of, you know, really neat things you might not have noticed in a segment we like to call Hidden Bullshit.
Secret things.
Okay.
How'd I do? Was that okay?
You did excellent. Yeah, you did perfect.
Right. Good.
This is a real simple one. When they in the opening credits, when they're zooming in on the pumpkin, when they zoom all the way in on the left nose or the left eye and nose of the pumpkin, it looks like Michael Myers' silhouette holding a knife.
Yeah, that checks out.
And
yeah.
Then later on in the movie, this is sort of referenced again when Laurie's walking towards the bedroom upstairs where her friends have all been collected, like her dead friends have all been like set up for a tea party. The light coming out of that room is orange, which is not a quality that any other light in the film has except for the lights inside the pumpkins.
Oh, that's cool. And there's a pumpkin there, right?
There's a pumpkin inside, which is ostensibly where that light is coming from. But that's was done very purposefully, obviously.
It's a pumpkin that's full of lamps somehow. Yeah.
And the way that the door is open, it's creating these very angular shapes on the floor that make you think of the eyes or like the, you know, the sort of very hard angles of pumpkin features, the jack-o'-lantern features.
Oh, that's awesome.
So it's like she's opening the jack-o'-lantern to go into that room. And there you go.
And again, this, if they had not gone with the Halloween thing and instead it had just been called the Babysitter Murders, you would have had to have had like babysitter symbolism everywhere.
Right.
Right. The light casts a shadow
been
of
very
like,
lame.
A list of phone numbers or something.
Well, he kind of does that because the phone is very important in this movie.
Oh, sure.
And it relates to the way he keeps showing you things in a normal setting, and then he shows you them in a scary setting. Like, the girls are constantly calling each other or answer, you know, there's a lot of phone calls.
Dirtbag Paul takes the phone off the hook, and then they die.
And then the very last phone call anyone receives is Linda on the phone, and then she gets strangled to death on the phone, which had been this very normal thing that the three main characters are using to communicate with each other.
It's actually really cool.
And then it slowly becomes scary, and then
Oh, it's got everything.
Yeah. But I don't know what else the babysitter, like, I don't know, pizza?
It's not
like,
a lot of tropes, yeah.
No. Parents getting home later than they told you they would.
No tip. I don't know.
Chilling.
Yeah.
Did you have anything?
I had one thing with it. We talked a bit about how the movie's all from sort of a stalker perspective, and a lot of that means far away shots of people.
Mm-hmm.
I also read something, I forget where, but it was arguing that there's a lot of shots where it starts wide and then slowly moves in on the characters, so it kind of feels like they're being trapped in the scene. And I think also the way it's wides all of the time, in particular when Tommy, the kid that Laurie's babysitting, sees Michael across the street in the shadows, it's from very far away and he's just like a little speck on the screen. And there's a lot of other times where Laurie and her friends are walking home and they yell at Michael in the car and Michael stops, and it's creepy that he stops for a while and goes,
yeah,
but it's it's from him. It's from all the way away. Like you're there watching him across the way. Anyway, all the wide shots, all the far awayness to it, it makes like Michael's very small in a lot of the shots. Like he's very background or almost kind of hidden. I think that's a really cool way to symbolize what they're getting at with evil being everywhere and evil being a force that you never know where it's coming from. Like you have to find the evil, like Where's Waldo in a lot of the
basically,
scenes
yeah.
in the movie.
You never really. It's also a way of obscuring him because you never really see his mask very clearly.
Yeah.
I think the clearest you see it is at the very end when he's attacking Jamie Lee the last time.
Yeah, they finally blow it out at the end. But until then, it's like you as an audience member are constantly watching every corner of every frame to find him because they keep him so small.
They hide him. If you go back and watch it, I bet there's probably at least one where you missed him. Because they do put him in, Carpenter puts him in a lot, and sometimes it's real subtle. So
yeah, and he's like just touring the town
a lot. Yeah, he's just standing. Yeah, like, he spends the first half of this movie driving around, which is amazing.
Like he's like a dad. He loves to putter. You know, he just loves to kind of boop around town and see what's around.
I feel like that is important, but I don't know why. But it was after this film when we decided that slasher movie villains shouldn't be seen driving anymore. I think that's the most surprising part because that part of the trope got dropped. He spends like half of the time in a station wagon sort of driving around town. And the idea of like Jason Voorhees behind the wheel of a car.
It's wonderful.
Like he just shows up in places. Yeah, they decided that. Whatever it was that humanizes them too much or whatever.
I think it's, that's imagining him doing like a mundane task. it humanizes him too much or it makes him not scary in some way.
Well, we did a live podcast a few years ago and I have this whole theory where there's a part in Friday the 13th part 2 where the only way from Jason Voorhees to get from place to place is for him to have stolen a bicycle. Because there's no way he would know how to drive a car, but he was a normal kid at one time, so he does know how to ride a bike, and he got there faster than what walking would have gotten him. And in the lore of the films, he has no like teleportation, but just seeing him on a bicycle just for a few frames would ruin the entire experience.
And he could have gotten one because he kills the crazy old man from the first movie that shows up briefly in the second movie, and that guy is riding a bicycle.
Oh, yeah.
So maybe he stole that guy's bicycle after he killed him. Either that or he's riding around in an ATV. We bring it up a little bit throughout here, but just Carpenter's conception for Michael Myers, who we mentioned is called The Shape very purposefully, was a person who was, he wanted to make the person be impossible to relate to. So that's why they chose the mask that they did. We never see it clearly. It's a person, but we don't see it clearly enough ever to really register any features. And then anyway, they took the features and distorted them. They made his eyes too big. I think they cut the nose down or something. They painted it and they added weird hair to it. It's supposed to kind of look like a photo negative of a person. He's meant to be the abstract force of evil rather than an actual character.
Yeah.
That's kind of what the point that the Halloween remake missed is the fact that it's not important why Michael murdered his sister. He just did. Like, that's all that's important. And also the mask is very important to Michael. We see like he picks up that mask and puts it on in the beginning, right before he stabs his sister to death. And then when they take it off him, he's catatonic.
Yeah.
Like there's that very long, and it's kind of silly because his parents aren't moving. When the POV flips and we see Michael just standing there with a stunned look on his face and the camera draws away from him, it's because they pulled his mask off.
And oh, that's so cool.
He can't move anymore. And in the end of the film, when he's fighting with Jamie Lee and he's killing her, she pulls his mask off and he stops and lets her go because he has to pull his mask back on.
Yeah. And his real face looks a little bit messed up and it's very chilling. It's really cool.
Kind of, yeah. Interestingly, yeah. Carpenter points out in the commentary that they didn't do anything to the guy's face. He has one eye that's kind of swollen because he got stabbed with a coat hanger, but it's just a dude. Like they didn't.
I just made fun of a guy. All right. I apologize.
No, but I mean, I think it's a combination of things. It's a combination of the swollen eye is the first thing you see, and the fact that he's not really lit. He's in kind of like angular shadows. And also the fact is we're kind of expecting him to look kind of fucked up.
I thought there was something up with his nose. I don't know why.
There might have been.
Maybe not.
But it might have just been like Carpenter insists that they didn't make the guy up at all. It just they just put the wound on his eye.
I think it's the shadows, and I think it's you assuming there's something horrific under there.
Because
it's not. His face doesn't expose for more than a few frames. Like, he immediately grabs it back down. But again, this is another case where if they put a script doctor on this, the first thing they're going to insert is like they go to the library and they find a book about there's a spirit that inhabits the mask and anyone who puts it on. And it's like, no, all you need, you show it twice. Like, that's it. You hint at it, and then that's all you get. The victim, you know, Lori doesn't know, so you don't know. You know, the whole point is, this is her insulated little world, and this strange evil is in there. The, you know, if she doesn't know what's going on, why should you know? But, you know, now the format for, like, a Paranormal Activity movie, you've got to have the demonologist that comes in and explains. And that's why I don't like Dr. Loomis's character in this, because it's like John Carpenter felt like you needed these speeches explaining. It's like, no, you don't. We get it. Like, when we see him escape, his character's defined by everything, how he behaves, you know, and that's it. Yeah. And from then on, you just watch him work. You don't have to have somebody telling us, you know, the mythology of Michael Myers.
Right, yeah.
It's there. We can watch it.
It's all there in the visuals, yeah. Now we're going to segue to a segment that talks about scenes that would have enhanced or ruined the plot, in a segment that we like to call bonus scenes that should have existed. Okay, right away, I really need a scene where Michael Myers combs the house for a bedsheet, cuts eye holes into it, retrieves Paul's glasses from his dead body, puts the sheet on, puts the glasses on, over his mask, in the dark, and walks back upstairs to stand in the doorway and wait for the girl to notice him.
It's a really elaborate bit.
It is the zaniest thing he does in the movie. Like,
that's the kind of prank where, like, as a person doing it, you're halfway through prepping it and you're like, this is a lot. They're going to think I'm weird.
Yeah, I'm doing too much work. Happens. Yeah, it's just going to be weird.
It'll be embarrassing for me.
I'm just destroying these people's $40 sheets just for this 1 second of levity.
Well, it's a strange house. He doesn't know where they keep the linens. How long was he looking for that sheet?
Like, has anyone ever asked John Carpenter what that scene was? Like, why he does that?
He mentions it was an idea that Deborah Hill had, like, the day they were doing it.
Feels like it.
And he thought the image was creepy, so he's like, sure, let's do it. And so it's in the film.
And the remake.
I was going to say, it is kind of creepy until you think about it in this context. And you're like, wait, what the hell? That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
In the remake, they fixed this because it's the boyfriend who goes and cuts up the sheet, does it because he's going to. And then Michael, before that guy can get back to the bedroom, Michael grabs him and kills him and then takes the sheet off him and puts it on, which still doesn't make a lot of sense. But at least it's like it was the boyfriend who had the wacky idea and then Michael's now in disguise. I think the one thing that would have made that scene better is if the girl, when he came back to the bed, if she would have reacted thinking it was a ghost. Like, just started screaming. Because there's a ghost.
Just full on Scooby Doo reaction. A ghost.
Anyway, my bonus scene, I badly want an after credits epilogue in which Dr. Loomis has to call his superiors back at the hospital and explain what he's been doing for the last couple of days that he's been off work. It's like, do you remember the patient who escaped and we just didn't call anybody to tell them he was on the loose, even though he has a violent, violent history? I took care of him. I tracked him back to his hometown and I shot him off a balcony with my 6 gun. But he ran away. It turns out he's bulletproof. It turns out he became bulletproof at some point when he was in our custody. I don't know how. I think it's because he's pure evil. Anyway, I'll be back on Monday, but I know in the sequels he continues to pursue Michael Myers,
right.
So he winds up taking several weeks of vacation to go pursue this patient. And then on the other end of the line, you just hear that faint sound through the phone sound of like, this is not part of your job. You do not.
Well, I want to hear, like, at the end of that, it's like, well, yep, so I tracked him down and shot him and he fell, but it turns out I'm gonna go ahead and send you my expense report for all the driving and the bullets.
The bullets.
I had forgotten that he explicitly tells the sheriff not to call anyone.
Yeah, really. Yeah.
He's like, no.
Yeah. It's just going to get people riled up. Just tell your people to keep their eyes and ears open and let me ambush and kill Michael Myers.
What an
asshole. The sheriff is like, all right.
Yeah.
Yeah, the sheriff's not like, well, no, I'm a sheriff and I'm going to do what I do. He
also
doesn't do that at all.
All the sheriff does in this film is startle people. You know, is that it's like two different scenes where he just Batmans up behind somebody and startles them.
And in fact, if he could just inform the doctor, it's actually illegal to ambush and murder someone, even if they've committed a previous crime.
Right.
That's not self-defense. That's you're not allowed to like just hide in the bushes and shoot somebody dead, like, because you don't know he's going to attack you. So no, I actually can't just give you my blessing, because I feel like I, the sheriff, am going to have to be explaining this to someone tomorrow, why I let this doctor come from out of town and ambush an escape patient, because I think like the odds of this going well are really slim.
Alex, did you have one?
Yeah, well, because speaking of people's jobs, earlier in the film, Michael, it's off screen, but he steals a couple of things from a hardware store. He steals a mask and rope and some knives, and you learn about it because the sheriff's telling people about it. I just want to see the hardware store owner get back, realize that a couple things have been stolen, and then just pursue the thief on principle. Like, he just spends like the whole rest of his days like, nobody steals a rope from me. It's the principle. Like,
what did Michael ever end up using that rope? Like, I don't remember seeing a rope.
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think it really paid
off. Unless he used it to pull the tombstone out of the ground.
Well, when Laurie goes into that room with all her dead friends, one of them swings down. Maybe it was just another bit of like Michael whimsy, where he's like, oh, this will be fun if he like swoops in, you know?
Yeah, Michael's watching that happen, and she doesn't laugh. She just screams, and he's sitting there in the corner like, nobody gets me. I also want to see a shot of Michael somehow unlocking Annie's car, which is a really subtle detail.
Yeah.
And then just sitting in there fogging up the windshield with his heavy breathing. It's just...
And again, if she doesn't come back to the car and changes her mind, how long does he wait before realizing she's not going to come back? This is the fun thing. Anytime a killer like stakes out a location, it's like, well, yeah, but what if she changed her mind and went out to eat or something for the next 3 hours? Like, were you just going to sit there the whole time? And
it would be like Loomis. We keep cutting back to Michael. He's just sitting in the car, like looking around. Like, I don't think she's coming back.
like dozing off. Yeah.
He's like, did she get a ride? Like, I don't. Yeah. Man, damn it, Michael.
It's like when you play Capture the Flag and you try to stake out a defensive position and you realize after a long time that you just picked the wrong spot to defend. Like, nobody's coming.
Yeah.
That's both of them. Like,
man, I made all these snowballs. Nobody's coming for my fort.
Yeah. I did also, there's one part late in the movie where Jamie Lee Curtis is fleeing the house after she's been stabbed and bloody and stuff. Yep. And she knocks on the next house's door for help, screaming, and they just close the blinds on her.
And then turn off the lighting door.
And I want a scene of just that person sitting back down to do whatever they think is more important. Like, what an asshole. Let's explore that world.
What could they have been doing? It's like, well, I don't need this bullshit.
Yeah, like, I have a 1,000-piece puzzle to do or whatever.
Yeah. What an ass. So we watched the movie. Basically, this is a segment where we like to make some weird, non-intuitive arguments about things in the movies, which you've pretty much already been doing.
Yeah.
But here's the official segue into our segment, Let's Overthink It.
Because one of my favorites is, Jason, when you're talking about the car thing being, this is the first and last movie where an invincible slasher gets to drive.
Yeah.
It's great.
Well, we mentioned it already.
Yeah, we talked about it already. Yeah.
But the other chink in that armor is the fact that there's no way Michael knows how to drive.
It would have been fantastic if he had just been constantly running over curbs and stuff.
Just driving like an idiot.
It's clear he's never...
Maybe that's why he slams on the brakes. It's not because he's reacting to what he heard. It's because he doesn't know how to drive and he hit the wrong pedal and panicked.
Yeah. And again, if Loomis just calls the state police and says, yeah, he's driving the vehicle from the hospital, he's still in it. Like, here's the plates. It's marked as a state vehicle. Like, they could have found it in minutes somewhere.
Right. Like, that was like an official vehicle. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he continues to drive it in broad daylight. If they had just had an APB on it, like, the local cops would have pulled it over immediately. Because there's this vehicle from a state hospital vehicle and this huge man in a jumpsuit and a white mask driving around town. I get it's Halloween and you think, well, he's probably doing a bit, but if you've got in your notes like, hey, you know, be on the lookout, this guy actually escaped and stole this vehicle, that really solves your problem very, very quickly.
Right. He's very conspicuous. Right. You do have a point of absentee parents that I thought was interesting, Jason, if you want to talk about that.
Yeah, because we did a previous podcast talking about why sitcoms in the 80s were all about divorced parents and unusual families. And that's because in the early 70s, they legalized, basically made divorce much, much easier. Like no-fault divorce.
Right.
And the divorce rate exploded. So you saw that in popular culture. And you saw another generation in the 90s of writers who had been raised as in single-parent households and their take on the world. So we kind of dug in depth into that. And here you see it here, too, because this is 1978. And the whole concept of the babysitter killers is that you only see very brief glimpses of parent figures. You know, like the sheriff dad is useless.
Yeah.
Laurie's father, he's off selling real estate or whatever. And the entire concept is that Michael killed his sister who was supposed to be babysitting him, but she went and had sex instead very briefly.
30 seconds
and
of
so
sex.
There's this theme.
Not worth getting murdered for.
Yeah, there's this theme of him like taking his revenge on babysitters, these who, you know, you have a set of babysitters here and Laurie, who's very conscientious, and then like Annie, who's the party girl, and she's just, you know, like she dumps her kid off with Laurie. And that theme of like the parents being punished for leaving their kids with like a pseudo parent to watch them, and then the babysitters as these substitute parental figures getting punished for doing it badly, like they all want to go off and smoke and have sex or do whatever. And you would see that when they sat down to write Friday the 13th, which was a quickly slapped together ripoff of Halloween.
Yes.
To capitalize on the hit this had been. The concept of them being camp counselors is the exact same deal, because these are young, sexy people, but they are supposed to watch these kids at the summer camp, and they do it badly, because that's how Jason Voorhees drowned, right?
Because
they were off having sex, and he... So there's this theme that if you ask John Carpenter about it, I think he says that we're reading that into it, but I don't think he did it consciously. I think that was in the culture at the time, this sort of anxiety over we're leaving our kids with strangers more and more. It's all daycare now. It's all babysitters because we're all off pursuing our careers or doing whatever. But that became like a standard in these slasher movies. And we our obsession with like punishing these figures lives on to this day.
That's really interesting. Yeah, interesting point that I never thought of.
And I think you're dead on that a lot of it or all of it is unconscious on his part, because they've also interviewed John Carpenter and Deborah Hill about the sort of rule they put into the movie where people who have sex are then killed.
Yeah, the morality play part of it.
And they both say it wasn't conscious at all. Like, they were just trying to find a way to put it in the movie. Carpenter said, it wasn't my intention to make a moral point. And Hill said the people who mentioned that in reviews applied their own morality to it. I thought they were ridiculously introspective about a film that was meant to have no social statements.
I do kind
of. And yet it's full of them.
Yeah, it is.
You can't make a piece of art without making social statements.
Yeah, because...
Like you just, it doesn't matter whether you want to or not. If I make a movie about a home invader and then the heroic final moment is me, the homeowner, shooting the guy in the head, I have accidentally made a bunch of statements about... guns,
right?
Yeah,
about when it's appropriate to use violence, about what you should be afraid of in the world. It doesn't matter whether I intended to send those messages or not.
Yeah.
I have all these subconscious things that I'm relaying.
For sure,
nothing is created nor exists in a vacuum. So it's all a product of its time and its environment and everything. I can see Carpenter and Deborah Hill not intentionally putting that in there, because he explains the ones who are sort of irresponsible getting killed because they're the ones who aren't paying attention. So they're not noticing Michael. And Laurie's the one she wants to be partying, but she just can't.
Yeah.
So, and she's the one that notices because she doesn't have anything better to do but watch, you know, like, or be observant. According to Carpenter, the first part of the movie was meant to be contemplative, which makes sense because he's just showing you all these suburban landscapes. You're being painted a picture of serenity, you know, peaceful all-American life. And that all happens during the daytime. And then when the second half of the movie begins, the second act, it's about slowly introducing darkness, like slowly degrading that image, slowly tearing it apart. And that happens at night. And you see all the characters in basically the same places in two houses that are not inherently scary. It's just by changing the lighting and he's set up this threat and then injecting it in there. It's just corrupting or making what we're used to and what's like normal and comfortable uncomfortable. And that's why he ends the film with a montage of different shots of the house, because it's like,
yeah,
here are these normal places that have now been, they're now colored by what the terrible thing that happened in them. Like, it's just a completely normal couch or a completely normal bed, except you know that somebody was murdered there. And I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. And one of the simplest low-budget things you have working for you as a resource is day and night. Like, he just maxes that out so effectively. Especially because so many movies and shows now are just visually dark all the time, whether it's night or day.
Right.
Like, everything's gray, you know? And when I watch older movies like this one, they don't even have to be that old. Anytime it's daytime and things are colorful, I'm like, oh, what a period thing to have light and
this must be deliberate.
Bright reds. Amazing.
Yeah.
And I guess this is part of why, because earlier we were making fun of the fact that they're trying to dress up LA as Illinois in the fall. Mm-hmm. And I guess the reason it has to take place in Illinois is they imagined that there must be these fictional small towns where there's no such thing as crime.
Yes.
Because this is a movie where whenever, like, she's approaching the abandoned, creepy old house, it's like, well, don't go up to it. There could be ghosts in there, or the Wolfman. It's not, well, don't go up to the abandoned house. There could be, like, a meth addict living in there who's going to assault you and stab you because you're intruding on their meth den. And that's interesting to me because I would like to know what the atmosphere really would have been like in a place like that in 1978 or, you know, 77 where they were shooting it. Because the 70s were the heyday of the famous serial killers.
Yeah.
The headlines were everywhere. Like, the Zodiac Killer continued in the early 70s. Ted Bundy was 75. Son of Sam was 76. Like, these were fresh on everybody's mind. And yet they intentionally have all these lines of dialogue where it's like, well, is the boogeyman real? It's like, no, you know, what are you talking about? The idea of somebody going out and just murdering people for no reason. And I doubt that was the mood. Like I think the idea of a killer being loose in the town, I don't think that is the equivalent of telling people a vampire is loose in the town. Like, I think people would say, oh, like, yeah, like Ted Bundy, who did travel everywhere and just picked up random people. Like, it feels like the teenagers, and I get that that's for story reasons.
Right.
Because they work really hard to build this place up as where they think they are absolutely safe, to where one girl walks around in her underwear in the neighborhood for a while.
because protracted period of time. yeah, I think it's all archetypal, I guess, which... You know, there's a quick point I wanted to make is Michael Myers is literally the big bad wolf. Like, she walks up to his house and, you know.
Oh, it's all the beats of the fairy tale.
Wanders into his domain. And so he spots her and just starts following her. And then the rest of the film, he, like, you know, he comes into the house and lies in wait for her in the bedroom. I mean, it's all about, you know, getting a monster's attention in a place that you think you're safe, but not. It's really his domain. And then he follows you all day long. Kills everyone around you.
Sort of I have a super silly fan theory, which is that Michael Myers is Jaws reincarnated as a human.
Sure.
Because he's such a blank in such a purposeful way that completely works in the movie. But also, if you decide to watch the movie from a perspective of he literally has a shark's brain and specifically a killer shark, then everything plays. Like, Loomis's speech about him having black eyes, that's almost the Indianapolis speech.
yeah.
And his immediate need to kill, even though there's not a particular reason for it explained, and his stabby approach to it, it's always with knives, you know, like shark teeth and so on. It doesn't totally make sense, but it's just a fun way to look at it. I don't know.
No, it works.
As fan theories go, very dumb, but I don't know. If you want one, there it is. Yeah. You know,
the shark also has some zany moments in Jaws. Where he does unshark-like things just for the purposes of frightening people. And it's like, oh, well, they have that in common.
Oh, Jaws should have worn a victim's glasses. That would be great.
Float around in a sheet, swimming around in a sheet. Okay, so we talked about the movie was made and about some secret hidden messages that may be lying in the movie or may not be. We may be reading too much into it. Now, we'd like to talk about, this is a segment we do now at the end of every month, because this is going to be the last episode of John Carpenter Month, where we like to talk about which movie among the body of work that we discussed this month should be on the gold record that we send into space. So the big question is,
on record movie,
do we show this movie to aliens? Now, the movies we discussed this month were The Thing, Escape from New York, They Live, and now Halloween. Of those four, which one would you put on the gold record into space?
I mean, I feel like this movie, Halloween, scares the aliens the most. The Thing probably scares them the least.
Because, well, two of the movies are explicitly about evil aliens.
Yeah. So. I don't know. It's a tough, as far as just a pure what totally encapsulates Carpenter, I think you probably use something like Escape from New York. If you want to do something that encapsulates a whole genre, you do this movie, Halloween, probably.
Jason, what do you think?
Well, you don't show them the thing because they're just going to spend the whole movie like criticizing the alien. Like, well, I wouldn't do it like that. But no, in all seriousness, I think if you show them this one, Halloween, I think they could glean a great deal about Earth culture from this in terms of our attitude toward mental illness, our terrible understanding of evil and immorality, what human fears look like, just the state of like families and our anxieties and everything. It's all there. It's a great time capsule for the period. And it's a movie made very quickly and written very quickly that is surprisingly has a lot to convey.
Yeah.
It's a good example of cinema in general, I think.
Yeah, man, I don't know. So many of Carpenter's movies are pretty good in terms of being a time capsule because he's a very politically angry man, or at least not angry, but like he's always very contrary to what the big political push is at the time. So, you know, it's Escape is a very post-Watergate movie, and then They Live is very anti-Reagan movie, and The Thing is also sort of a Red Scare, but also like the suburban fear that he sort of kind of scratched the surface on in Halloween.
He does a lot of fear and a lot of collapse and a lot of
it's all about the
holding together.
Exactly, yeah, the breakdown of institutions. Man, I want to say The Thing because it's legit one of my very favorite movies, but I think probably Halloween, right?
Yeah. Well, Halloween includes The Thing, sort of. Like, they watch the titles to the earlier Howard Hawks version of
that's
that
true.
Story.
That's true, yeah. And that
so
was
it's
actually
kind of all there.
That's actually John Carpenter's personal copy of The Thing that they're watching.
Oh, no way.
And yeah, I think I might have to say Halloween, just for all the reasons Jason said, and just because of as important, as good and as classic a film as The Thing has turned out to be, I don't think it had the same effect that Halloween has had.
Sure.
In terms of cinema and in terms of just encapsulating what mood was at the time. So, yeah.
Get ready for a spooky time, aliens.
So aliens are going to watch some Halloween. So, yeah, we're done here. We want to talk to you about how you can talk to us. So check us out on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Cracked Movie Pod. Please hit us up with your thoughts, people. We want to hear them. We want to hear what directors you want us to cover. I've been Tom.
I've been Alex.
And
this is Jason.
Yeah.
I write as David Wong.
Jason, where can we find you online? What do you want to plug?
Just I'm at Cracked. I'm somewhere on there at all times. Otherwise, the book again is called What the Hell Did I Just Read? If you don't trust me, read customer reviews of it on Amazon and see if the strangers can change your mind because the reviews are very good.
Yeah, you're getting you're getting a lot of 5 stars in there. It's great. It's a fun book.
And if you at home have enjoyed the book, leave a positive review for it because it helps Jason immensely and it takes you like 2 minutes.
Yeah,
it definitely does.
It 100% helps.
Yeah.
Well, we've been honored that you joined us, Jason. Thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you.
And next month we're starting John Hughes. John Hughes month is going to be November.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what movie we're going to cover first. Probably 16 Candles, I think.
I'm just stoked it's going to be an Illinois vibe for many more weeks.
In another fake town in Illinois. Is it all Shermer, Illinois? It's all like this.
Yeah, it's like his fake Winnetka on the North Shore there.
I like the idea that in Hollywood, Illinois is like this wonderland, that this far-off place that you can make this imaginary place with, and especially if you watch the 2007 Halloween, like it's inverted because to them, Illinois is just this hellhole of white trash screeching at each other and everybody is filthy. Like in every case, it's like they're making a movie about China. Like it might as well be Mars.
Right. Like for everyone's purposes, like Illinois is just like the plateau from the Lost World. It's just like whatever you want to be going on there. It's there and it's completely separated from the rest of the world.
Right. America, you get it.
Yeah.
Like that's Illinois in movies.
All right. That's it. Watch on, movie people.
Hello, everybody. My name is Jensen Karp, and I am the host of a show called Get Up On This right here on the Earwolf Network. We've been doing it for over 300 episodes, so we're celebrating by sitting down with a hip-hop legend, my favorite MC, Wu-Tang Clan founding member Method Man. That's right. For over an hour, we talk about his music career, songs he's released. We talk about his television appearances from The Wire to the brand new show The Deuce, and also the debut of Drop the Mic, which is a show that I created and co-executive produced on TBS. It debuts October 24th at 10:30. It's where celebrities rap battle against each other, and I swear to you, it's better than that sounds. I promise you that. But listen, you could download our episode now at Apple Podcasts or on the Earwolf Network and listen to an engaging conversation, sort of candid. A lot of stuff comes out with literally one of the best rappers in the game still, Method Man. We hope you listen, and yeah, whatever. Have a good time.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.